Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Craig Box with my very special guest host, Alex Ellis. It was a busy week last week at KubeCon, so I have to ask you, Alex, did you manage to take some time off and perhaps do a little bit of gardening?
I did. Actually, I've been spending far too much time in my garden shed and have these lofty ambitions of converting it to a space where I can go and retreat and do a bit of work and a bit of gardening.
And of course, there's no gardening these days without some technology. So tell us a little bit about GrowLab.
GrowLab is something that's started in 2017. I put a Raspberry Pi on the side of a plastic box and took a time lapse, and a couple of people got involved with it. And we had some fun. And then I didn't think about it until this year. And I thought, you know what, I want the camera to be over and above. And so I was brainstorming a few ideas of how I could actually make that happen. And part of that was using some copper piping, just like you'd have in your plumbing at home, baseboard of wood. I got it all working and thought, I shouldn't keep this to myself. The benefits of community and of learning new skills and just taking time out to do things that aren't productive and aren't going to make you a success is just leisure. Are really underrated, and I wanted to share that with other people.
It is. It's always fun. I watch a bunch of YouTube videos of people who just do something interesting that they enjoy, and it's great when that shows up, and it's great that you get to share that with people. Bring a little bit of functions as a service in there as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, so there's actually three experiments now, and just to prove that you can take things far too far, I've registered a domain name. I've got a logo for this. We've got 15 different people registered. And to make them feel like the scientists, we call them lab technicians. So you're a lab technician. We've got 15 of them. There's three experiments. The first is the one that's the contest. So if you want to win a prize from OpenFAS Limited or Pimeroni, what you do is you take a time lapse over 2 weeks, and there's some other things to do as well. And that gets you into the contest. The video can then be generated through FFmpeg, a standard Linux tool. The second thing you can do is a live preview, and that's what uses, again, Python and humidity, temperature, and air pressure sensor. And I thought, well, actually, I've done this before. I want to make it really easy for people to have a data logger. And so I have one in my shed, one in the arbor, which is like an outdoor seating, and one on the GrowLab. And I plot all three of them using an OpenVAS function to receive the data, update an InfluxDB database, view it with Grafana. And because I don't want a heavyweight Kubernetes cluster to run it all, I just used OpenVAS's new FASD project. It just does everything for you.
Well, you can learn all about Alex's projects in our interview in episode 116. A number of them loomed large in KubeCon last week. There was a mention of OpenFAS in the RISC-V keynote, and the K3S project you've been doing a lot with, you've actually made a training course for Kubernetes on Edge, which was announced at KubeCon last week.
Yes, and that's something that was put together for the Linux Foundation and CNCF together. And I think they just liked the course that they did on serverless on Kubernetes so much that we wanted to work together again and had this great idea with K3S coming into the CNCF. Could we help people understand Edge, LF Edge, the whole landscape, what SOCs are like and what the difference is? But you keep finding people asking about K3S, you know, what is it? Why is it different? When should I use it? And so we cover a lot of that. And then one bit I'm really excited about, just the basics of Kubernetes, probably a condensed version of probably what you need for CKAD. How do you use a pod? How do you use an ingress? How do you build a container image? And then finally, get to tie it together again with a little bit on OpenFAS and functions, Rancher's Fleet Project, Flux, Continuous Deployment, HA, and I think if you're anywhere near Kubernetes, you'll really enjoy this course.
Maybe we need to tie these concepts together a little bit. We need some sort of certified gardener where we can go through and talk about the process of germinating seeds and so on. There was so much I saw in the GrowLab stuff. I'm like, this is all very technical and I've never really given too much thought to it, but I'm sure that I would probably be better off if I learned it rather than just experimenting.
Yeah, I mean, I did a talk for Equinix Metal at their Giphy Day. That's Google infrastructure for everyone else. So obviously you get to access a Google infrastructure yourself, but the rest of us, Craig, we kind of playing with our Raspberry Pi, simulating it. And I was asked, can you do something that shows how to get commodity low-powered hardware into the hands of people and they can do something interesting? And so I took on the challenge And I even sent the talk to my mum afterwards, and she said, are you trying to be Monty Dom from Gardener's World? Because at the end of the talk, I showed how my tomatoes had fallen over in the wind last year. I'd showed how my aubergines hadn't grown quite big enough and how it overwatered things and everything I'd learnt. And yeah, there is so much to learn about nature, but the great thing is it doesn't really change much, unlike tech.
Well, I will just point out that Google infrastructure is available to everyone else in the form of Google Cloud, but gardening information is probably not my forte, so do check out GrowLab for that, and let's get to the news. Microsoft announced an open source project to bring eBPF to Windows 10 and Windows Server. An eBPF runtime and a bytecode verifier are built into the Linux kernel, and many networking and observability utilities make use of this feature. The Windows work is based on two existing projects, a user space runtime and an extended verifier. The project is still in early development, but it is being shared to start a collaboration with the eBPF community. In related news, Google Cloud's eBPF-powered Dataplane V2 for GKE is generally available this week.
Confluent for Kubernetes is generally available. Confluent is a commercial Apache Kafka service, and with this new release, you can run it inside your own environment. The operator-based install handles upgrades, scaling, resilience, and monitoring.
VMware Tanzu SQL now supports MySQL, joining Postgres as supported database systems that you can install with their operator. The new product installs the Percona server variant of MySQL. Also from VMware this week, a new modern apps connectivity solution, which brings together the capabilities of Tanzu Service Mesh and NSX Advanced Load Balancer, and runs on almost any Kubernetes.
Finally, every year, the Dora team, now at Google Cloud, runs a State of DevOps survey and publishes a report based on the findings. The survey is for everyone, regardless of how far you are on your journey or the size of your team. Dora says that even reading the survey questions can spark ideas for improvement. So that's another good reason to check it out and play your part in this community survey.
And that's the news. Zane Asgar is the GM of Pixie and New Relic Open Source, and CEO and co-founder of Pixie Labs. He is also an adjunct professor of computer science at Stanford and was an entrepreneur in residence at Benchmark before co-founding Pixie. Ishan Mukherjee is lead product go-to-market at New Relic and co-founder and chief product officer of Pixie Labs. Ishan led Siri's Knowledge Graph product team at Apple after the acquisition of Lattice Data, a Stanford-based startup where he led product and go-to-market. Welcome to the show, Zane.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for having us here.
And welcome, Ishan.
Thanks, Greg. Thank you for having us.
We've got a lot to talk about today, but to set the scene, can you give us the 90-second elevator pitch about what Pixie is?
Pixie is a Kubernetes native observability system which helps collect telemetry, so metrics, traces, events, and logs for all workloads inside Kubernetes without the need for any code changes. The second thing is the Pixie, as Zane will share more, lives entirely inside the Kubernetes cluster, so no data has to get stored or persisted outside of the cluster. And then the third is it exposes this kind of interesting interface where the API allows you to write scripts to do production and troubleshooting, but also build a lot of interesting applications using telemetry.
Pixie Labs emerged from stealth in episode 124 and was acquired by New Relic in episode 132. Now, not 5 months later, the team has followed through with the promise of open sourcing and submission to the CNCF sandbox. Your company was founded in August 2018, which is around the time of episode 15, in case you were wondering. But your stories will have started a lot earlier. Perhaps you could both start by sharing the first memory you have of when computing came into your lives.
I had this 286 computer a very, very long time ago. I can't even remember what year it was. I'll actually share a couple of memories. The first one was my dad had just bought a 40 megabyte hard disk. Mm-hmm. I was very excited because the original hard disk on this computer was 20 megs and I had 60 megabytes total. That was quite an accomplishment for computing back then.
How were you possibly going to fill that?
Right. I thought this was, I can install anything and download whatever I want and life is good to go. Similarly, I also had this 286. I don't know if you want to call it a laptop because it was quite heavy to be a laptop. I like to call it a backtop, which was kind of like the suitcase computer.
Yep.
With this very monochrome screen. And of course, also had like 20 megabytes of disk space because that was state of the art.
Was that what your career was basically from the moment you very carefully picked that up?
Pretty much, you know, I was a child. It was actually quite heavy to lift as a kid. They weigh like 30 pounds. It's quite ridiculous.
So he was either going to go into weightlifting or computer science. It was one or the other.
Pretty much.
Ishan, how about you?
For me, I grew up in really small mining towns in India. So we are far removed from kind of what was happening in the US and in the Western world. So there was a lag, which doesn't exist anymore. So there was a lag in that technology adoption. But my brother, who's a surgeon now in New York, he is a hacker. I remember he was in the eighth grade. He started to write GW Basic programs to make a ping pong game. And he used to take these kind of massive notebooks and write all the routines, like go to 10, go to 80, all of that stuff. So I remember as a small kid kind of just reading through that and kind of thinking about, wow, this is possible. So that was my first example. But that quickly switched to going to the local government office to set up your Alta Vista email. That's how I got looped in. But very quickly for me, like I was pretty obsessed with kind of building bikes and robots and stuff. So for me, like, computing with both hardware and software, and that's how I got into like mechatronics and robotics.
Now, you've obviously had a great career. You're a startup co-founder. You've been acquired recently. Do your parents still think of you as the kid whose brother's the doctor?
I still do think that they think that I am an IT person, which is less valuable to society than being a surgeon. But no, they're all super proud. I think at least back in India, they know what software is, but their view of software is an IT person. I don't think I'll ever be at my brother's level.
Well, you did work at Amazon through the acquisition of Kiva Labs, who makes some very interesting robotic technology. Tell me a little bit about your time there.
I moved here to the US for grad school at MIT. As part of that, in that MIT ecosystem, there were a bunch of robotic startups, iRobot, Kiva. It's a very healthy kind of robotics ecosystem up there in Boston. So Kiva was essentially building robots which help fulfillment workers inside warehouses pick, pack, and ship your e-commerce order. So it was still a pretty nascent industry, essentially robots in the most unglamorous industry. So what we used to do was obviously build the hardware, but also essentially this control system which organized products inside of our warehouses so that after the order comes, you can kind of ship that out in like 30 minutes or an hour. And my role there was to kind of build simulation systems to figure out for like a large warehouse, whether that's Target or Office Depot, like how many robots do you need? So that's how, as an engineer, I got in like thinking about the customer's need and this pretty sophisticated technology. Kind of fast forward to now, we got acquired by Amazon. So Kiva became Amazon Robotics. Now, I think the Kiva robots run most Amazon warehouses. So it was pretty interesting in an application of fundamental research.
Is robotics basically just becoming machine learning with arms?
I think that's a really good point. And that's where Zen and my kind of shared kind of passions come from. Like I was obsessing a lot about just automation and thinking about the human and the machine interface, and the hardware and software had a part to it. But with Kiva, like what ultimately became clear was the right path to automation was mostly software driven. And at that time, there were two schools of thought. There was the one school of thought where you build these sentient singular robots, were essentially kind of RoboCop-like smart humans. And the other one was kind of really reduce the reliance on the hardware and do all of the logic at the software as well. And that's where Kiva were pioneers. Like the robots in itself are actually quite naive. It's like an army of tens of thousands of robots all talking to the central service, right? So with that, now 15 years since that started, ultimately, a lot of it is software driven. And then the robots in itself are, as you said, for arms or for actuation, right? Whether you're picking up stuff, whether you're moving stuff. And it's an interesting interplay. Obviously, like Zen does research on like edge stuff, where a lot of the compute now can move to where it makes more sense because of all of the innovation. But ultimately, it's a pretty elegant balance where you have this tiered intelligence model. But I do think primarily, increasingly, it's a software driven automation world.
And Zane, most recently you were working in the machine intelligence group at Google. I hear that's quite a good place to work.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Some interesting stories from there. Like when I first started working there, one of the first projects I worked on was actually doing apparel recognition, something that I can say I have absolutely no skills on.
As in, this is a shirt, this is a pair of trousers, etc.?
Well, I think I can figure that part out, but it was like, which one of the million handbags is this?
Right.
And that was a lot more challenging for me because first I didn't realize that there are a million different types of handbags.
Can you tell the difference between a blueberry muffin and a dog?
That's a different challenge.
It's an unsolved problem.
Yeah, that was someone else's challenge. My unsolved problem was, can I tell the difference between these two Gucci bags? And I'm like, I'm not sure I can tell the difference, but maybe a computer can. Let me try.
Was that for the benefit of detecting counterfeits?
No. So actually, a lot of these features became a core part of what is now Google Lens. I think it provides a few features, right? One of them is just like allowing people to do like shopping. Oh, I'm really interested in this handbag. What is it? And then also providing an experience around like finding something similar or like matching styles. And that was like the very first project I worked on. So it was quite interesting because I went from not knowing anything about being completely naive about fashion to like browsing random fashion websites to like find trendy data. So it was quite an adventure. In more seriousness, the area that I really focused on was on-device machine intelligence, which is where Sean was alluding to earlier, where we're trying to get all these models to run on like actual edge devices, whether it's cell phones or Raspberry Pis or something similar.
Right.
I continue to work on that area actually at Stanford and still collaborate with people from Google in that space. Interestingly, this all actually ties back to Pixie. Bringing that up, I was working on all this like edge ML stuff, started working on machine learning, teamed up with Ashan, and part of our thing over there is we can get access to rich data sources. Can we actually process all of this at scale and make it useful for developers? That's where the tie-in actually happened and continues to happen.
When we spoke to Ramon from Octeto in episode 125, he basically said that his founding team were looking to build some software, but then they ended up having to build tools to help them build that software, and then they decided to commercialize those tools instead. So my question to you both is, what systems hurt you so much that you were looking to build a better developer experience?
I built a fair amount of production software during my career, and I'm actually one of those people who really, really likes to make sure that the stuff I deployed continues to work, as I'm sure most software engineers are. But one of the things I feel pretty helpless about is when things break in production, of like, please help me figure out what's going on, send me the logs, and you never have the information you need to debug this available. And sometimes the debug loop can be really long, right? Like you've got to go add more logging, send it back out, hope the problem occurs again in a time when you're watching and be able to capture this data and debug. Part of what we wanted to fix with Pixie is actually just shorten that entire feedback cycle. As like an engineer who's building production software, if I see something wrong, can I actually get visibility to that code, figure out where performance issues are occurring, figure out what function call arguments are without having to go through this entire redeploy cycle, which could be like a week or two at some companies or even longer. Mm-hmm. That was the main thing that we were going after, is just like, how do we actually get things installed, not have to worry about it once things are running, be able to get all sorts of data to be able to debug actual production issues.
Obviously, kind of from an experience standpoint, while we were kind of thinking about it, my previous role was one of the lead product people at Siri and inside Apple. And when you're leading a large kind of consumer application, you're pretty much on call 24/7 because there's some part of the world that there's a wrong utterance. So like as Zen was mentioning, anybody kind of leading applications at scale, like it is a daily occurrence. But kind of beyond that, both of us and the team that we have, we're essentially product builders. So we were looking to build a product which is just fundamentally better and hopefully helps define the next decade in that domain. And we experienced it on our own. We felt like we could deliver something that was truly magical in this space and for an end persona that we relate to really well, which is developers. We have this academic background and startup background. Ultimately, we try to build like a truly an amazing product experience. This seemed to be like the most exciting opportunity for us to go do that.
One of the things that jumped out at me when I was reading the announcement was that you use eBPF to collect the data, the metrics and traces and so on, for application Kubernetes operating system. Could you have built something like Pixie before eBPF became mainstream, or is it really tied into being able to get that without having to add any instrumentation yourself?
I think the question really is could we have built something from a technical perspective, and also could we have built something from a distribution perspective? From a technical perspective, could we have built what we did without eBPF? I think the answer is yes. We could have built a special kernel module. We could have done some binary instrumentation or something, things that people have done in the past, mm-hmm. and be able to build that out. The problem is deploying those things can usually be very cumbersome and difficult, right? Like getting people to install kernel modules on production environments is usually a no-go.
Yeah, it's like curl pipe bash, but even worse.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the binary instrumenting applications is another challenge, right? Because you can start off with someone's application, you're like, okay, well, please let us instrument this before you deploy it. And it can be quite a chore to actually make that happen. The other approach, of course, is that you can do like language-specific agents, right? Where you actually go and add in some specific annotation or import some libraries. This works well with dynamic programs where they can basically monkey patch your code. And a lot of existing agents do stuff like this. Like if we take a look at like New Relic or Datadog or whatever, they try to do this by importing language-specific agents. Mm-hmm. What eBPF really allowed us to do was do some of the things that like kernel modules could do or even like binary instrumentation could do, but automate that behind the scenes, considering it's a core part of Linux.
Add an anecdote to that. We spent a lot of time just talking to developers, even before we decided, hey, this is, we both of us are going to do this like full time. The question that we were initially kind of looking to answer was, can we collect all this data without doing any work? And eBPF became a means to that end. With eBPF, I remember like having that conversation and then getting conviction. Okay, like we feel like we can truly optimize this multivariate equation. And oh, this makes sense. Just to add the point that eBPF initially was a means to the end of getting all this data, and we wanted to kind of deliver that kind of experience to the developers.
Kubernetes effectively requires you to build distributed systems and that you need to run multiple copies of things. I find that it's very easy to conceptualize how you can monitor a single static thing running on a kernel, and you can clearly do it easier and better with something like eBPF. How do you then think about the distribution of those applications, and how do you treat things that are running in multiple different machines as if they are one instance of a thing?
That's a great question. For us, Kubernetes actually also provides us with a very standardized substrate where applications are deployed, and also a very, very rich metadata stream. Part of what we do with Pixie is that we actually monitor the Kubernetes metadata stream, so we know like what pods and services are running, and we can use that to actually automatically gather a bunch of information about the services. The other thing we do is we take this really, really low level information coming out of eBPF, which is usually tied to like the process level of that machine, and then really tie it to these high level concepts from Kubernetes. And you know, without a system like Kubernetes actually doing all this bookkeeping behind the scenes, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to do what we're doing with Pixie. In addition, Kubernetes also provides Pixie the ability for us to actually manage our deployments on cluster without having a really hard time just managing a remote deploy somewhere.
Is Pixie inherently a Kubernetes tool, or can you use it to monitor other things?
The way we think about this is that Pixie is Kubernetes native, so it was built for Kubernetes, right? Mm-hmm. Probably unlike most apps, it was only designed initially to run and work on Kubernetes. We do want to add support for gathering telemetry from other Linux machines, as long as the customer has at least one Kubernetes cluster where we can funnel the data to. Pixie's data system and machine learning and everything rely on having a Kubernetes cluster to host our stuff.
So let's talk a little bit about the architecture. And for anyone who's sitting in front of a screen right now, there's a link in the show notes to an architecture diagram. But for those who are just listening, perhaps out walking the dog, can you paint a picture in our minds about how the different pieces of Pixie come together? We've talked about eBPF and getting events out of kernels. We've talked about getting the event stream out of Kubernetes. Where do all these things go? And then how do people visualize and interact with them?
From an architectural standpoint, they're basically like three-ish layers to Pixie. So I'll start at the bottommost layers because that's where eBPF stuff's located. So we deploy these things called PEMs, which stands for the Pixie Edge module, as a daemon side on Kubernetes. So It gets installed on every single node. Right, so it's important to understand that it's one per node, not one per application or anything else. And what the PEM does is it actually does two things. The first one is it's responsible for collecting all the data on the machine. And we use eBPF and other Linux APIs and everything to capture data. So this actually will capture both application level data, HTTP requests, database calls, et cetera, et cetera, along with all the system metrics. In addition to that, it also hosts the edge part of our data processing system. Part of the challenge we have with eBPF data is that it allows you to capture like orders of magnitude more information. And it's actually pretty difficult for us to ship this stuff upstream anywhere, right? Because we're monitoring every single network request. There's no way we're going to ship that off the box.
How quickly will you fill up your 40 megabyte hard drive?
Yeah, exactly. That would be pretty much instant these days, but network bandwidth. So what we actually do is that we do a fair amount of processing locally to be able to figure out what we want to send, figure out what's interesting to keep, and then also to compress the data or for us to actually store it. Mm-hmm. The second part of our system is this thing called Vizier, which basically is our semi-centralized data store that sits completely within your Kubernetes cluster. And what this allows you to do is that, you know, you can write scripts, which are written in like a Python dialect that actually uses Pandas effectively behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Our entire data system is based on the Pandas API and Arrow. And you can basically write what we call pixel scripts and be able to execute scripts across the entire cluster without having to worry about where the data is located. So you can interact with like services and pods, and then we'll figure out where the data is located, because the data could be on the PEM or the data could be on Vizier, which is our semi-central data store. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like the second layer. And in that layer, we can really manage like all the metadata, the longer term storage. Like Pixie is only designed to store data for the last like 24-ish hours, right? Because it's mostly meant for debugging.
Yes.
The last layer is basically the UI layers. We do have a connection to like a cloud-based system so that we can do things like RBAC and security and all of that in a more centralized manner. And we also host our UI and APIs over there so you can interact with your clusters.
Now, your diagram does have a little label on it that says that no customer data is stored outside your network.
That's right, because we only need to store stuff inside of Azure, which lives entirely within your Kubernetes cluster.
And so when I'm connecting to the things that you have hosted as your cloud service, is it connecting back to my cluster and retrieving that as I need to see it?
That's right. We actually have two modes for this. One of the modes you can connect directly to your clusters. You never have to proxy the data back through us. We have another mode, which is a little bit easier to do if you have complex firewall rules and stuff that you don't want to have to deal with setting up perfectly, where we do like a reverse proxy to pull the data and then send it through your API. That way it allows you to easily access the data, but we don't actually store anything. It just proxies through our system.
Does Pixie handle the process of alerting me that something's wrong, or is it solely a tool that's used when something else has alerted something's wrong that I can go and find out why?
We don't do any alerting right now. There are a lot of other great tools on the market to do alerting. One of the things that we are working on and are shipping is OpenTelemetry egress. So we can actually egress our data out as OpenTelemetry. And once you get the data out, you can then send Pixie data to other tools, which can then do the alerting, and then you can pop back into Pixie for more details.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because New Relic also recently announced their commitment to OpenTelemetry as a standardized API. Do you think that the tipping point for OpenTelemetry has passed and it's now becoming the industry standard?
From an OpenTelemetry standpoint, Craig, there's two things. One, what's happening in the broader community, and the other specific to kind of vendors like New Relic and Datadog and Splunk. From a community standpoint, that is definitely the intent. The intent is to standardize on OpenTelemetry, starting with metrics, and then I think there's traces and logs next. There's a journey to it. It'll take a fair bit of time to get there, because from a customer standpoint, early cloud, legacy, early cloud to this kind of very modern kind of early stage startup, all of them agree that that's the direction that we need to move towards with everybody in their kind of relevant adoption points. From a vendor's perspective, New Relic has this really interesting kind of strategy where they do want to standardize on OpenTelemetry and open source all kind of instrumentation technologies that they have worked on, and Pixie is part of that strategy. So they obviously pioneered the APM space with their APM agents. They've actually open sourced kind of the last 8 to 10 years of R&D in agents, and kind of the kind of Pixie acquisition and contribution to the open source is part of that strategy. So the conversation that they want to have with developers is all software that's running in your environment will increasingly be open source. Once you're harvesting that data, you could build your own open source stack, whether that's Prometheus, Alert Manager, Grafana, or you could choose a high-end kind of SaaS managed experience, and New Relic tries to make the claim to be one of the better ones. Well, I think OpenTelemetry is increasingly becoming the standard, but it's going to take a while to get there, and then vendors increasingly are now standardizing on OpenTelemetry.
Now that you've open sourced Pixie, would you say it's open source as in I can audit it, or open source as in I can run the entire thing myself if I choose to?
To some degree, it can be both, but you can run the entire backend yourself if you so wish. Keep in mind that the Pixie backend, the Vizier and PEMS are already hosted by you, right? The question is, where does our cloud hosting run? And we also open source the cloud version of Pixie, so you can actually monitor and manage multiple deployments seamlessly.
All the way through, we've talked about the machine learning experience that you both bring. And you mentioned before some of the on-device work that's done to try and figure out what's important and what to save. In which other ways do you bring that machine learning background into how Pixie works?
It's kind of interesting. People always ask, you were working on like edge machine learning, and now you're working on like big servers. How is this even semi-related?
It's all just computers, isn't it?
Yeah. The first answer is, of course, they're all computers, and they all kind of work the same way and basically trying to optimize for the same stuff. But the interesting thing is, when you're a monitoring application, any resources or anything you use is like resources that are not available for the main application to use. Mm-hmm. Part of your goal is actually to make everything as efficient and low utilization as possible, which ultimately makes it not look very different than a very low powered machine on the edge. Some of the things we do with machine learning is trying to like facet out the metrics by different parameters in the message so that we can actually store exemplars and be able to make it easy to like slice and dice the data. Other things that we haven't done yet, but we've prototyped out, is doing semantic compression. So once we learn like schemas and stuff, we can actually easily compress the data so that we can use up less memory and storage space. Since we're looking at all of this data at pretty high throughput, we need to come up with some way to be able to manage all of this data at scale.
Yeah, one thing I would add to it is somewhat, I guess, special knowledge in some regards. Like as machine learning people, when we actually build the product, we kind of inherently make a lot of decisions which might be counterintuitive because we have this kind of data first view of the world. So as we were building up Pixie, things that Zen talked about, really deeply thinking about the data model, being architecting the platform to be able to view as much data as possible, and then making decisions to drop or keep later in the process, these all kind of resulted in how Pixie is today. So what you see it is it has a very novel UI, but it doesn't have the standard nested dashboards. Everything like fundamentally is this data first view. And those engineering and kind of product design decisions inherently happen because over the last decade, we've been just building these data first muscles. So yeah, from a product builder standpoint, there's a lot of things that are past also kind of gets baked in.
We mentioned before, you started building Pixie in August 2018. You launched a public beta last year. And at the time of your launch, you took a $9 million Series A investment. 8 weeks later, you were acquired. What can you tell us about the sequence of events?
We actually raised the capital that you talked about in 2018, when Zen and I started the company together. So we raised a Series A from Benchmark, Google Ventures, and a few other angel investors who became advisors. And then in the summer of 2018, we started to design and architect the platform. From a timeline perspective, we spent a lot of time. So we were at KubeCon 2018, talking to as many customers as we can. We did not start hardcore building until much later. I would say mid-2019, we started to have our first design partner contracts. And then around spring 2020, so this is like a couple of months before COVID, we got deployed in massive production scale systems just organically. Even though we were in alpha stealth mode, the early version of the platform was inherently very well received. And we started to get deployed. And around the COVID timeframe, we decided, okay, now we should plan for a public launch. And we put the October timeline. And between kind of March and October, we really focused on building out the community-driven kind of adoption. We started to build out this community called PixieNOS. These are early end users, but mostly kind of senior kind of principal engineers who are either on the platform side or on the perf side or maybe on the architecture side, who started to really try out the products. And then fast forward to October, we did do the public launch, but what was the basis for it was about 2 years of R&D, about 9 to 12 months of concerted customer deployments and kind of experience, and about 6 months of building out a community. So it was our coming out party, but we were doing a lot of the hard work before that, building up to it. So around the October timeframe, because of the amazing kind of real production use cases that we saw and the community adoption, we did get a bunch of kind of interesting conversations about raising our next round of capital or kind of potential kind of acquisitions. And that's the context in which Bill and Lou Cerny from New Relic came to us, and we had the conversations, and those led to us joining forces.
And you mentioned, obviously, this was all happening during the middle of the COVID pandemic. Is there a story about how Pixie made it possible to scale these applications that people were having to grow all of a sudden?
When Zen and I started talking to customers, obviously like 2017, early 2018, and a lot of the relationships that we built with engineering teams ended up becoming converting into like customers, and now they're some of our biggest champions. A huge cohort of that, Craig, were folks in the content streaming industry, some of the most household brands that you know, the top 1, 2, 3 kind of streaming companies. Their businesses were scaling like crazy during COVID. Everybody was affected. We were as well from all of the stuff that was going down. But from a work perspective, they were just seeing kind of transaction volumes peaking every single week, right? So really working with them, understanding their performance use cases and getting Pixie deployed and helping them troubleshoot outages, but also helping them support through peaks was something that we honestly did not plan for. We had aspirations to get deployed in production in these large kind of internet scale production clusters at some point in our company's trajectory, but that happening while in private beta during COVID was really surprising, but ended up becoming a real proof point for the technology that we were building.
New Relic recently announced that they've upgraded to become a platinum member of the CNCF. Is that as a result of this acquisition, or does it speak to other cloud native projects inside the broader company?
As we talked about before, so New Relic was always a very developer and engineer focused company. It was founded by Lou, who's famous for to be like a coding CEO. He still is today. A big part of their strategy for observability is now around merging metrics, traces, logs, events under this singular concept of observability. So they have a unified data system where you can ingest all this data and a very cohesive kind of user experience up on top. And then what they standardize on is the OpenTelemetry spec on the ingest side. with all of their investment in open source, them taking a governance seat in a CNCF just makes the most sense. It helps New Relic engage with their customer base and also with the project teams across CNCF in a pretty like high touch manner where they can essentially help contribute with the best possible outcome. So it was a part of their overall open source strategy. Obviously, Pixie was a huge part. So Zen represents New Relic and takes the board seat. From a Pixie standpoint, the level of investment is quite exciting. It is really, really amazing engineers. The entire kind of engineering team is mostly focused on open source development. So from the community standpoint, it's an exciting investment to really build out a very mature project. And not just as a side project, right? So you have some of the top engineers at New Relic just focusing on open source development.
And Zane, what are you looking forward to as a new member of the governing board?
Part of the thing that we're always interested in is just contributing to the open source community and being a larger player within the CNCF ecosystem. I think some of the stuff that we're interested in is just driving forward like adoption of open standards like OpenTelemetry and hopefully helping with Pixie and all of that moving forward.
You'll probably get a bit of parking space at the next KubeCon.
Hopefully.
Is Pixie Labs going to remain a separate brand, or is it going to become New Relic Cloud Native Monitoring at some point?
The current plan is to keep it a separate brand. The Pixie brand itself is going to be contributed to the CNCF. Mm-hmm. We're in the process of doing that right now. As part of the contribution, the branded Pixie project will become a CNCF project, and then New Relic will continue to host with Pixie.ai.
How else do you see the direction of the product evolving now under New Relic?
I think one of the main things that we're looking at is we want to keep this clean separation, right? So we want to have the Pixie open source be something like Chromium, mm-hmm. and the Pixie closed source version be a little bit more like Chrome, where we have some like potentially value-added things that you could use, like, oh, you can use the extension with New Relic and store 100 gigs of free data. But we do want to have mostly the open source experience.
One thing I wanted to add, which is quite bold from a New Relic's perspective, was that we are not using any licensing or any other kind of commercial means to restrict the usage of the core Pixie project by other entities, whether they're cloud folks or other folks in the industry. So as you probably saw in the launch, like AWS is investing heavily, and then a bunch of other folks who use Pixie already. As Zen mentioned, like the Pixie core project, which kind of runs inside of Kubernetes cluster, is quite decoupled from kind of New Relic in the cloud, right? So like the API is very much like an APM Ruby agent talking to New Relic. Similarly, Pixie is talking to New Relic. As part of this, we do expect and other entities to have managed versions of Pixie as well.
I should just point out, I did the maths. Your 100 gigabytes free is 2,500 times the size of Zane's initial hard drive.
Nice.
Do you hope that the open source core of Pixie will kind of become like Prometheus and become a thing that you sort of assume is installed in every Kubernetes cluster?
That's what we hope to get out there, is that Pixie is like a core debugging experience for every Kubernetes cluster.
What else does the future hold?
For us, we are really excited about just making tools for developers to debug production software. And we're going to be extending Pixie in various ways to do that. And we've been looking a lot into actually just getting code level visibility and live debugging with some of our new features. So if you want to check out things like Pixie's like continuous profiler, where you can get performance profiles, we're going to be moving a lot more in that direction of just enabling core developer use cases.
And at your heart, Zane, you are still a university professor. I understand you are publishing on the TensorFlow blog coming up soon.
I'm an adjunct professor, so I work on research at Stanford, and I have some students that I work on research with. Actually, as part of the Pixie open source project, we are publishing a blog on how we actually use TensorFlow within Pixie. Hopefully, look out for that in the next couple of weeks.
All right. Well, we very much do look forward to reading that and learning more about Pixie as the process of joining the CNCF continues. Thank you very much both for joining us today.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks a lot for having us.
You can find Zane on Twitter at ZaneAsgar, and you can find Ishan on Twitter at IshanMKH. You can find Pixie at pixielabs.ai. Alex, thank you very much for helping me out with the show today.
More than welcome. It's been a pleasure.
If you've enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at kubernetespodcast@google.com.
You can also check out the website at kubernetespodcast.com, where you'll find transcripts and show notes, as well as other links to subscribe. You can find me at alexellis.io or at alexellisuk on Twitter.
I'll be back with another guest host next time. So until then, thanks for listening.